Welcome back, listener. Ready for another deep dive? Today, those big ideas, citizenship and equality. We're going to look at a Supreme Court case that might just make you rethink them.
Yeah, what's fascinating about this case, Tuan Onguyen v. INS, is that it all revolves around a really specific situation. We're talking about a child born abroad to unmarried parents, and only one parent is a U.S. citizen.
Right, and you know how we do these deep dives. We're going all in. We've got a super detailed case brief and the full text of all the opinions. We're talking majority, concurring, dissenting, the whole shebang from those justices.
You'll see just how complicated these ideas of citizenship and equality can get when you look at this specific situation. How is citizenship passed down? Does the law, as written, actually treat mothers and fathers equally under the Constitution? Those are the big questions.
Okay, so let's set the stage. This case, it centers on Tuan Onguyen. He was born in Vietnam to a U.S. citizen father and a Vietnamese mother.
And they weren't married. Glenn eventually comes to the U.S., becomes a lawful permanent resident, and grows up with his dad in Texas.
Sounds pretty straightforward so far.
Here's the twist. Nguyen gets in trouble with the law, ends up facing deportation, and boom, suddenly his citizenship is a big question mark.
Hold on, wait. How can someone be a lawful permanent resident but still face deportation?
Okay, so this is where the nitty-gritty of U.S. law comes in. See, this case, it all hinges on one specific section, 8 U.S.C., section 1409. And this section, well, it deals with how citizenship is passed down to children born outside the U.S., specifically to unmarried parents. And here's where it gets really interesting. That law, it has different requirements depending on whether the U.S. citizen parent is the mom or the dad.
Okay, now I'm starting to see why this case ended up all the way at the Supreme Court.
Exactly. The big issue, the one the justices had to grapple with, was whether this difference, these different requirements based on the parent's gender, does that violate the Constitution? Does it violate that guarantee of equal protection? And get this, the court, they were split on this, which means we get a majority opinion, a concurrence, and a dissent.
Ooh, legal fireworks. All right, let's break it all down, starting with that majority opinion. Now, that one was written by Justice Kennedy, and they focused on two main reasons, two goals behind this law.
Right. The first one they call biological certainty, which basically means, well, it's pretty easy to prove who the mother is right at birth. It's undeniable. But with the father, it might not be so clear cut.
Okay, I can see that. But are they saying mothers are more reliable for citizenship or something?
Not exactly. What they're saying is that the law, it's acknowledging a biological difference, right? And it makes sense for the law to reflect that difference, especially in the context of birth.
Okay, that's nuanced. So what's the second goal the majority focuses on?
The second goal is about making sure there's a real chance, a real opportunity for a parent-child relationship to form. And again, they argue that just given, you know, the circumstances of birth, this is more likely with the mother from the very start.
So the majority is basically saying that the law is trying to, like, promote strong parent-child bonds. And having these different requirements is just a way to help ensure that. But doesn't that kind of make some assumptions about moms and dads?
Oh, you better believe the dissent is going to have something to say about that. But for the majority, this difference in the law, it's justified because it's rooted in these real practical differences between mothers and fathers at the time of a child's birth. It's not saying one parent is better than the other. It's saying the law reflects the situation, you know, the reality of it.
Okay, fascinating. But hold on, we've got two more opinions to unpack, right?
Right.
What about Justice Scalia?
Right, Justice Scalia. He agreed with the outcome, with the majority, but his concurrence had a different emphasis, a different focus. He stressed this key principle, the separation of powers.
Oh, yeah, separation of powers. Now, remind me, that's all about checks and balances, right?
Exactly. See, Scalia's point is that the court's job, it's not to come up with better ways to do things. That's Congress's job. What the court has to do is decide if the way Congress did it, if that's allowed under the Constitution. And Scalia believed it was in this case.
So it's like he's saying, even if we think the law could be better, it's not our place to rewrite it.
Precisely. The court, it's not supposed to be a super legislator, right? Yeah. Their job is to interpret the Constitution, not to create new laws.
Got it. Okay, so now on to the dissent. This is the one led by Justice O'Connor. This is where we get those fireworks.
Oh, they do not hold back. The dissent comes out swinging, arguing that this law isn't really about acknowledging real differences. It's about clinging to these old, outdated stereotypes about moms and dads. They're saying straight up that the government could achieve these goals, these same goals, without having this gender-based distinction in the law.
So they're pushing back on that whole biological certainty, an opportunity for a relationship argument.
100%. They're basically saying, look, there are other ways to ensure that biological connection and make sure there's a chance for a parent-child relationship without treating mothers and fathers differently just because of their gender. They're arguing this distinction, this difference in the law. It's based on outdated assumptions about mothers being naturally more connected to kids and fathers being less reliable.
It sounds like the dissent is saying that there's bias baked into the law itself, not just in how it's applied.
That's a key point, yeah. What they're arguing is that this law, even though it might seem neutral on the surface, it could actually be perpetuating these harmful stereotypes about gender roles. It's a really subtle but important argument.
Okay, yeah, I'm seeing how this case gets really complicated. You've got these huge ideas, citizenship, equality, parenthood, and they're all tangled up in this very specific legal situation.
And that's what makes this deep dive so fascinating. It makes us think about how these really big abstract ideas actually play out in real people's lives. We're talking real consequences here.
Absolutely. Okay, so we set the stage, introduced the key players, and now the battle lines are drawn. Where do we go from here?
Well, next, we need to really dig into those opinions. Let's get into the specifics, the details that make those legal arguments come alive. Sometimes it's the little things, the small details, that really help us understand what's going on in a case.
I'm all ears. Let's unpack it all, see how those arguments stack up. All right, listener, buckle up. Things are about to get really interesting.
Remember how the majority opinion talked about the mother's right to come back to the U.S. to give birth? That would make the child a citizen automatically, right? But the father, he doesn't have that same power in this situation.
Yeah, that's right. They were using that to point out how the law reflects the real-world differences between mothers and fathers.
Exactly. And the dissent, they countered with this really powerful point. What if the mother's relationship to the child is messed up somehow? Like, what if there's abuse or neglect or even something tragic happens? It makes you realize that these legal arguments, they're not just hypothetical. They're playing out in real life. And real life can get messy.
It adds a whole other layer, doesn't it? It's not just principles. It's about families, relationships, the impact these laws have on people's lives.
Absolutely. Another thing that stood out to me from the dissent was their argument that this law might actually make men less likely to formally acknowledge paternity, especially if they're worried about having to pay child support later on.
Oh, that's interesting. So are they saying that the law could actually discourage men from being responsible fathers?
They definitely hint at that possibility. It raises those questions about, you know, unintended consequences. A law can be designed to do one thing, but then it ends up creating all these new problems.
That's a great example of why these deep dives are so valuable. Things aren't always as simple as they seem on the surface.
Right. And that's why it's so important to look closely at those opinions, the details, the arguments. It's like putting together a puzzle.
Well, speaking of puzzles, what about that historical context that the dissent brought up?
Mm-hmm.
They mentioned a history of sex discrimination in similar laws. What did they mean by that?
Well, they basically pointed out this pattern in U.S. law where mothers were almost always seen as the primary caretakers, especially for kids born outside of marriage.
So the thinking was mothers are more connected, so they're more responsible, and fathers don't have the same obligations.
Pretty much, yeah. And the dissent, their argument is that those old assumptions, those historical assumptions, well, they influenced the laws that came later, like this one we're looking at, 8 U.S.C., Section 1409. They're saying this law might be based on outdated ideas about men and women, even if it doesn't come right out and say so.
It's amazing how those biases can stick around, even when they're not as obvious as they used to be.
It's a good reminder that laws don't just appear out of nowhere. They reflect the values of the time when they were written. And sometimes those values, well, they need to be re-examined.
So given all this historical context and everything we've talked about, do you think this case would have been decided differently if it was argued today?
Whoa, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? It's a tough one. No easy answer, of course. But it is important to remember that how we think about gender roles, about parental responsibilities, all of that has changed so much since this case was decided.
True. And those changing views could definitely affect how a court today would interpret those governed interests. You know, the biological connection and the chance for a relationship.
Exactly. You know? A court today might be more sympathetic to the dissent's arguments, the ones about stereotypes and whether there are other ways to achieve those goals without treating men and women differently.
Okay, so let's zoom out for a second. We've been deep in the weeds of these legal arguments, but what actually happened? What was the outcome of the case?
Well, ultimately, the court sided with the majority opinion.
So they upheld the law, even with those concerns about potential discrimination.
Yeah. The court decided that the law, as it's written, was a reasonable way to go about achieving those government goals, you know, making sure there's a biological connection and a chance for that parent-child relationship to develop.
I bet the dissent was not happy about that.
Oh, yeah. They were definitely concerned. They argued that this ruling could end up reinforcing those harmful stereotypes we were talking about, the ones about the roles of men and women in families. They were worried about the law being used to justify discrimination in other areas, too.
And this decision obviously has a ripple effect, right?
Yeah.
It goes way beyond just Nguyen.
For sure. It affects how we figure out citizenship for all these children born abroad to unmarried parents where one is a U.S. citizen. And it brings up this whole debate about how the law should deal with biological differences while also upholding equal protection for everyone. It makes you think, what does it really mean to be a citizen? How do we define family in the eyes of the law?
This is some heavy stuff. So what does it all mean for us, listener? What are we supposed to take away from all this?
Well, on a practical level, it means that this law, 8 U.S.C. Section 1409, it's still the law, but it's also a reminder that the legal system, it's always changing, always evolving.
It's not like the Supreme Court makes a decision and that's the end of the story, right?
Nope, not at all. This case might be over, but the discussion about gender equality, about citizenship, all of that continues.
It's like legal precedent. It's not set in stone. It's constantly being reinterpreted, reapplied as things change and we understand things differently.
Absolutely. There could be future cases that challenge similar laws, or maybe they'll use Tuan Nguyen v. INS to argue for a broader view of equal protection in other areas of the law.
It's like each case builds on the ones that came before, shaping our understanding of what's right and fair under the Constitution.
Right. And those legal principles, they end up impacting our lives, how we raise our families, how we interact with each other as a society. It's a reminder that the law, it's not just some abstract thing. It has real-world consequences, and those consequences are real for people.
And those consequences can be huge, like in Nguyen's case.
You said it. He was facing deportation, being separated from his family, a completely uncertain future. His whole life was on the line because of his citizenship or the lack of it.
It reminds you that behind all the legal stuff, there's a human story. It's a story about hope, about fear, about fighting for what's right.
Well said. And those stories, they're what make these deep dives so captivating. They remind us that the law isn't just a bunch of rules. It's about how we live and how we treat each other.
It's about finding that balance between what individuals need and what society needs, between acknowledging that we're different and still striving for equality. This case really got me thinking about how we can acknowledge biological differences without letting those differences lead to discrimination.
That's the core of it all, isn't it? Finding that balance where the law recognizes that men and women are different in some ways, but it doesn't use those differences to give one gender an unfair advantage.
So where do we go from here? What are some of the bigger implications of this decision? What does it all mean in the grand scheme of things?
Well, one thing this case does is shine a light on how our understanding of science is changing, especially when it comes to biology.
Oh, yeah. Science is always discovering new things, challenging what we thought we knew. How does that play into a case like this, which is all about these biological distinctions?
It's a great question. Remember, the majority opinion put a lot of weight on those biological differences between mothers and fathers when a child is born.
Right, like how the mother is always there at the birth and the father might not be.
Exactly. But science is always moving forward, and what we understand about biology is always expanding. New technologies, new research, all of that can make those seemingly clear-cut differences more complicated.
Like, what about all the advancements in reproductive technology? That can make it harder to rely on those traditional ideas about biological parenthood when deciding who's a citizen and who's not.
Exactly. And scientific advancements could change how we think about proving paternity, too.
Didn't the dissent say that DNA testing makes it pretty straightforward?
They did, yeah. But as technology gets better, we might find even more accurate, even easier ways to prove parentage. That could undermine the whole reason for treating mothers and fathers differently in these situations.
It's wild to think about how science can influence how we interpret the law. You know, it blurs those lines that used to seem so clear.
And that leads us to a final thought-provoking question. How should the law keep up with all these advancements in science?
Right. Should we rethink laws like 8 U.S.C. Section 1409 now that we understand science better?
That's a question for the lawmakers, for the legal experts. But this case, it definitely shows us that where law and science meet, that's a place where things are always changing.
It reminds us that we can't just go with what we think we know. we have to be open to new discoveries, to how they change how we think about these big ideas like citizenship and equality. It's like this whole case, it opens up all these bigger questions about science, law, and how they fit into society.
Exactly. And we need to have those conversations, especially if we want a legal system that's fair and keeps up with the world we live in. You know, before we wrap up our deep dive into Tuan Nguyen v. INS, I want to leave you with something to think about.
Oh, I love these final thoughts. They always get me thinking.
Okay, so this one goes back to the core of the case, that balance between what the government's trying to do and that idea of equal protection. Remember, the majority really focused on the government's goals, you know, making sure there's a biological connection and a chance for a parent-child relationship.
And the dissent argued that you could achieve those goals without having to treat men and women differently under the law.
Exactly. So here's the question I want you to consider. What happens when those goals, the things the government's trying to do, bump up against individual rights? Specifically, the right to equal protection under the law.
That's a tough one, right? Where do we draw the line?
Right. And in this case, the court said that line, the way it's drawn in the law, well, it's constitutionally okay. But as things change, as we understand these issues better, that line might need to move. What we think is fair and reasonable today, it might seem discriminatory or outdated later on. This case is a reminder that the law isn't stuck in time. It changes as society changes.
It makes you wonder if there are other laws out there where we see this same tension, where what the government wants and what individuals need might be at odds.
That's a great point, and it highlights how important it is for us to be engaged citizens. We have to stay informed, participate in those debates, and fight for a legal system that actually reflects our values.
Because at the end of the day, the law is a reflection of us, of who we are as a society. And it's our responsibility to shape it, to make sure it upholds those values of justice and equality.
Beautifully put. Tuan Nguyen v. INS might just be one case, but it brings up so many questions about citizenship, biology, gender, the whole foundation of our legal system. And those are questions that each of us needs to wrestle with as citizens, you know, as an informed, engaged citizens. So listener, we'll leave you with this. What do you think? Where do you draw that line? How do you think this case will affect our laws in the future? How do you think it'll affect how we understand equality?
That's a great way to wrap things up. This deep dive has been amazing legal analysis, philosophical questions, and a whole lot of, whoa, I never thought about it that way before. We covered a lot of ground today, from the details of Nguyen's case to those bigger questions about citizenship, equality, and how science and law are always pushing and pulling on each other. It's been quite the journey.
It really has, and it's a journey that doesn't stop here. We encourage you to keep digging into these issues, talk about them, and question what you think you know, because that's what a true deep dive is all about. Not just understanding the facts, but really grappling with the bigger questions they raise.
Well said. And on that note, it's time to wrap up this episode of The Deep Dive. We hope you found it insightful, thought-provoking, maybe even a little mind-bending. Until next time, stay curious and keep those legal minds sharp.